Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you today, Wednesday, August 21st, 2019. A top rebel commander is reportedly killed in early morning fighting in Awil.
The fighting has occurred at 2 a.m. today until at around 4:30 a.m. That's the time stop, and it was happening in a place called Wanachen in Korok area.
And one of the two female members of Sudan's new Sovereign Council says she will fight for the rights of all Sudanese.
Our rights as Christians is stipulated and enshrined in the constitutions. We just need to practice and demand those rights as any Sudanese citizen.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior rebel commander has been killed in Awil State during pre-dawn clashes between South Sudan People's Defense Forces and rebels of the South Sudan United Front loyal to General Paul Malong. The spokesman of the South Sudan United Front, Sunday Dejan, confirmed the clashes and says one of his commanders was killed in the attack at Wan Asian Village. Dejan says his group also killed a senior commander with South Sudan's government troops.
The fighting has occurred at 2 a.m. today until at around 4:30 a.m. That's the time stop, and it was happening in a place called Wanachen in Korok area.
Where is this Wanachen? I mean, where is it exactly in Awil State?
Wanachen is located in Awil North formerly, that is now currently a part of Lol State.
And who started the fight?
The fight was started by the government forces, because our forces were moving out and they had the intention to cross the bridge to go to the other side of the river to avoid the clashes, based on the fact that we have heard the outcry of the society and we wouldn't be interested in staging a fight within the civil population. However, our forces got ambushed by the government forces and they started now to fight at the bridge.
And how big is your force?
Well, on military aspect, you don't necessarily enforce the size of your force, but our force is significant and is everywhere.
There are pictures circulating on the social media. It is alleged that it's the picture of one of your senior commanders.
We can confirm that Brigadier Manud Yelwal has fallen in that battle.
What do you mean has fallen? I mean, Brigadier Manud Yel was with you, was he
Yel,
one of your commanders?
Yes, he was our deputy commander and he has been killed. He's the deputy commander of the force that was fighting in the morning.
How many people were killed in this attack?
In this attack on our side, we have lost seven soldiers, including the commander, the deputy commander, Manud Yel. However, we shall be updated by the forces later on. And on the side of the enemy, the commander of the force that was attacking our force has also been killed. Major Garang Yai has also been killed by our forces.
We are also getting reports that one of your commanders, called Kwal Atwai, has been captured.
That is unconfirmed. It is unconfirmed. You know, the government was interested in enforcing whatever they have done to us. And we have seen they have already circulated the picture of a person that has been killed. Why is it difficult for them to circulate the picture of a person that they have captured? Kwal Atwai has not been confirmed dead or captured in any way, but he is with his forces somewhere within the territory.
How many areas are under your control in Awil State?
Well, we cannot establish and tell you that we are controlling this and this because our force is not fighting in Awil necessarily. They are only passing, going to their side of mission. And that is why they have been stopped by the government on the way and fought them there. That is not our strategic area for fighting.
What is your strategic area for fighting? Where is your strategic area for fighting?
Of course, we are advancing to Juba in many directions. That is where we will fight. Fighting in places like Awil does not create or effect the regime change that we are desiring.
You are speaking about fighting when the signatories to the Revitalized Peace Agreement are meeting in Addis Ababa to see where they have gone wrong and how they can improve on implementing this deal. Why are you talking about war when people are talking about peace?
We have not started any war. It is just our forces that are being aggressed. And if you have aggressed the forces, there is nothing they can do but self-defense and advance to the direction that they have determined to go to. This war is being started by the government. rejecting us to be part of peace and starting war with us to destroy the peace.
Can you tell us how many assaults your forces have been involved in with the government of South Sudan?
From then to now, they are about six.
Where were you attacked? Could you tell us the exact location?
Three on Juba Numuli Highway and three in the territories where they have fought today again.
So you're telling me your forces are stationed on Juba Numuli Road and others are in Awil?
Of course, we have forces everywhere in South Sudan. We have forces even inside Juba.
How would you react to the government saying U.S. is nothing but a propaganda?
There is no propaganda that involves death. We have lost a commander today and they have also lost a commander. Is that a propaganda? Have you not confirmed from them that he's dead?
You're saying that your forces are inside Juba. So I'm telling you, how would you react if the government says U.S. is nothing but a propaganda? How would you react to that if the government tells you that?
Sir, we don't rule out their opinion. They have their opinion. They are entitled to it. But the truth is, they'll always be hearing it. Even Kiir himself is aware. Even his forces, he knows they can be loyal to us. Well, we are determined to fight after Salva Kiir has rejected peace. There is nothing we can do but to remove him by force because he has not accepted the peaceful mechanisms, even allowing us to table the ideas that we think are deemed to be the necessary alternatives for the country to be stable. He could not allow them to be heard.
That's Sunday Dijon, spokesman of the rebel group South Sudan United Front. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Nairobi earlier today. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has been sworn in as the head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, the body that is expected to lead Sudan's transitional government over the next three or so years. Other members of the Sovereign Council, including two women, also took the oath of office today. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
General Burhan took the oath of office this morning as the head of the Sudanese Sovereign Council in the presence of Chief Justice Abbas Ali Babikir. Nine other members of the council were immediately sworn in. Muhammad Al-Hassan Al-Taishi, a representative of the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, is yet to arrive from the United Kingdom for his swearing in. Rajani Kola Abdul Masih, the only Christian and one of the two women in the council, said she is honored to serve her country. Speaking in Arabic, Nicola says she is not coming to represent Christians, but to serve all Sudanese people, regardless of their religion.
Our rights as Christians is stipulated and enshrined in the constitutions. We just need to practice and demand this right as any Sudanese citizen, regardless of our religion, our affiliation, our race, or color. We are just Sudanese citizens and Christian.
Nicola says the Sovereign Council's first priority over the next 3 years should be focused on silencing the guns everywhere in the country. She called on the Sudanese people to unite and work for restoring peace, stability, and justice in Sudan.
We shall try to rebuild our country. We shall try to rebuild our economy. We shall begin to stop all the armed movements and work for peace and justice for all Sudanese on an equal basis, regardless of race, religion, or any political opinion or affiliation.
Nicola is urging the Sudanese revolutionaries to be patient as the new transitional government is formed, which she hopes will rebuild the country.
What happened in 30 years cannot be rebuilt in 3 years, but we shall try our best to do whatever we could. We shall be holding a lot of meetings with our heads of the council, and we hope things shall work out.
Muhammad Abdallah Hamdok, the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition appointee for Prime Minister, is expected to arrive from Ethiopia this evening ahead of an announcement of his official appointment. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The Sovereign Council replaces the Transitional Military Council, which took charge after months of deadly street protests that brought down longtime President Omar al-Bashir. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Nua Zain, a Sudanese visiting professor at Rice University in Texas and a spokesperson for the Freedom and Change Forces, about the prospects and challenges of a transition to democracy in Sudan.
What makes me hopeful? In the beginning, this revolution has a lot of pitfalls and some obstacles, but people managed to cover it. People insisted and they encouraged each other to continue. You know? And that was led by the Sudanese Professional Association under the umbrella of the Freedom and Change Forces. But by the end, the will of the people, Sudanese people themselves, that's what makes me really hopeful. They really now very aware about what they have, about their rights, about their strength to change their destiny, you know, in Sudan.
As the Sudanese agreement was signed with much celebration, pro-democracy movement is still feeling that Bashir's regime was so deeply entrenched that it would take time to dismantle its political network. Is that a real threat to a successful transition to democracy in Sudan?
Yes. But given the reality now in Sudan, the deep state or al-Bashir regime of the former totalitarian regime existed for 30 years, as you know, and it still existed in all kinds of our governmental or society institutions and all offices. And they still exist and, of course, will work hard to violate attempts to bring peace and or to revive the economy. But at the same time, given the reality of the events and what happened in the past 8 months, the removal of this blind state and concerted efforts of the transitional governments now to implement the emergency plan that was already prepared by the forces of freedom and changing when they made the declaration will be implemented by the Executive Council. And we do trust the Executive Council to manage this deep state. And, of course, by the cooperation with the Sovereign Council, as you know.
There are some pitfalls that can derail such transition, like Islamists in the army, political Islam in the country. Don't you think these are also hurdles to democracy in Sudan?
No, not at all. Because people, you know, experience this kind of Islamic divisions and parties in Sudan, and they had the chance already for 30 years to do whatever it takes to make Sudan better and or to prepare better future for Sudan, but they failed to for that, you know, and it was like all of kind of corruption, violation against humanity, you know, all kind of using their authorities for their own benefit. So people now, they're very aware about this kind of what we call Islamic division inside Sudan.
So who could domestically obstruct the roadmap and lead a counter-revolution, especially with the rising influence of General Dagalo?
Many leaders. You don't have to give a specific name for that, you know. All of those icons from the totalitarian regime will be set or present for free trial. This is number one. For the rest of them that is still free, for the coming few months, we will see what's going on with their future, you know, in Sudan. But regardless, we still know that they are still there. But if you are talking about Deglo or Hemiti, as you said, and this counter-revolution, so the issue of justice in the transitional government now is a fundamental issue. There will be independent investigation commission to look for all kinds of crimes. So if Deglo or anybody else inside the Sovereign Council or in anywhere, that will not be beyond the law from any kind of accountability for any reason. So even the glory, anybody else.
That was Nua Zain, a Sudanese visiting professor at Rice University in Texas and a spokesperson for the Freedom and Change Forces. She spoke earlier today with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawy. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The leader of the founding faction of the SLM is in Juba. Find out why when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
Is there ever a time when information should be censored?
For public interest, there's no information that is supposed to be restricted. Because we need information, and the public needs information. They need awareness. They need to know what is not known.
I believe there are certain times when information has to be censored when it may lead to misunderstandings and wars and maybe riots.
I think it depends on the situation. If a censoring will bring peace, then we should do it.
Yeah, it will depend on the way you had the information or the way you explained it to someone. If it is a bad information, so you just know the way you are going to explain to that person, the way to understand.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The head of the Sudan Liberation Movement, or SLM, a rebel group operating in the Darfur region, met with President Salva Kiir in Juba yesterday. Arko Minawi says he agreed to negotiate with the Sudan Transitional Military Council in talks spearheaded by President Kiir. But he warns that without the involvement of regional countries and IGAD, there will be no lasting peace in Sudan. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA. Away from Juba.
President Salva Kiir invited SLM leader Arko Minawi to Juba as part of South Sudan's efforts to lead peace talks between Sudan's military leaders and Sudanese anti-rebel groups that have been fighting for years to topple the government in Khartoum. Minawi emerged from a Tuesday meeting with Kiir that lasted a little over an hour, sounding optimistic about the future of Sudan. Minawi welcomed South Sudan's peace initiative.
This peaceful negotiation, we believe that the government of South Sudan, especially Mr. Salva Kiir Mayardi, the president of the South Sudan, he knows that how to start that peace. For his knowledge that the South Sudan and the North Sudan, they've been one nation, and that is why he recognized.
Minawi says yesterday's meeting centered on how the SLM can join the other Sudanese rebel groups in joining negotiations with the Sudan's Transitional Military Council on how to foster lasting peace in the country following the ouster of former President Omar el-Bashir by Sudanese military leaders in April. His ouster followed months of protests in Khartoum and other major Sudanese cities that began over skyrocketing prices for bread and fuel but morphed into demands for a democratic government. Tuesday's meeting is the latest in a series of talks held by Kiir with the leaders of various Sudanese armed groups in recent weeks. Minawi says Kiir should invite other independent stakeholders into the peace process, countries like Egypt, which have been long-time supporters of Bashir, in order to foster lasting peace in Sudan.
We can collect and mobilize all the regional countries, especially those affected countries like Chad and Egypt and Ethiopia, in order to create the solid ground for the peace and negotiation between both, between the nations of the North Sudan. And we agree that, and also we will support, we recall everybody can support by any means to make this mission succeed.
Minawi's group was the main SLM faction founded in 2002. Since then, five SLM factions broke away from the Minawi's group. The SLM was founded by leaders of ethnic groups in western Darfur to resist what they termed injustices imposed by Khartoum on the people of Darfur. According to Radio Dabanga, an independent local news outlet in Sudan, the SLM Inawi faction and other armed groups under the Umbrella Alliance, Sudan Revolutionary Front or SRF, rejected the recent deal reached between the Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition in Khartoum. In a recent statement, Minawi described the recent deal reached in Khartoum between the opposition and the military as an old fish in a new pot, adding that was designed to oppress the regions in the margins through civilian legitimacy. Speaking in Arabic, Tut Galwak, President Kiir's security advisor, says the South Sudan government is planning to host a joint meeting between all Sudanese armed groups and the Transitional Military Council in the next couple of days.
There will be a delegation from Sudan headed by Hemeti, the deputy chair of the Transitional Council, with his group so that we can reach an official agreement in Juba between the military council and all the armed groups and other groups that have come here under the auspices of the leadership of President Salva Kiir.
Galwak refused to take any questions from reporters following his meeting with Kiir. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A policy analyst at the Sud Institute think tank in Juba says President Kiir's decision to reopen 4 out of 6 South Sudanese embassies recently was based in large part on the fact that former Foreign Minister Niel Deng Niel, who Kiir fired this week, unilaterally decided to shut down the embassies 2 months ago. A foreign ministry spokesman says Niel's decision to close those embassies tarnished South Sudan's image overseas. Lasuba Membo has this report for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir's decision to reopen the 4 embassies was announced by government spokesperson Michael McQuay on Friday following a Council of Ministers meeting.
The president has set aside the order which was made for the closure of some embassies. And those embassies which were closed have been, another order has been issued reinstating them. And now these embassies will continue to operate.
When contacted for further details, Marianne McCall, the Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson, said the decision to reopen the embassies came after the government realized it needed more diplomatic engagement now than ever before. In May, Juba dismissed 40 diplomats working at various embassies around the world, claiming they went away without official leave. At the time, Foreign Affairs Minister Niel Deng Niel explained that because of resource constraints, the government had to cut back on its diplomatic representation abroad. McCall says, although the initial idea was to cut government expenditures by reducing the number of embassies abroad, the decision was not helpful.
Closure will not help because we need to expand. You know, South Sudan is a new country and it needs to have engagement outside as more as possible. So I think that closure was not meant to harm relations, but as I said, it was a result of the financial constraint that the country is running. But as we reverse the decision to maintain the embassy now, I think that is also good for both of us.
Abraham Maulik, a senior policy analyst at the Sud Institute, blames former Minister Niel Deng Niel for all the trouble. Aulic says President Kiir directed Niel to downsize his staff at the embassies, but instead Niel unilaterally decided to close the diplomatic offices without consulting the president.
It appears that the foreign minister didn't do his homework well, did not consult the leadership as well as the country's concern.
Aulic says though the move to cut down on operating expenses abroad was genuine, there should have been a proper consultation with those countries as to what the government was planning to do. Aulic says the response from the respective countries was negative, a situation the president realized was too risky for his government to carry out.
The president has set aside the order which was made for the closure of some embassies. And those embassies which were closed have been, another order has been issued reinstating them. action, and now these embassies will continue to operate.
Awulich says policy analysts and ordinary citizens alike wondered why the government would dare to break diplomatic ties with a friendly state like Norway that have generously supported South Sudan for many years. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
We turn to Zimbabwe now, where activists and the main opposition party say the country is not ready for the end of U.S. and European sanctions and accuse the government of continued human rights violations. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's sympathizers say lifting sanctions will help the country's ailing economy, but economists disagree.
Tatenda Mumbearara, the leader of the activist group Citizens Manifesto, is recovering in a private hospital after he was abducted by about 10 armed men whom he suspects are members of the security forces. Mumbearara opposes planned protests by regional leaders to demand the end of Western sanctions imposed on former President Robert Mugabe and his allies in 2002 for election rigging and human rights abuses. He says the recent crackdowns by security forces on protesters and a spate of abductions show that Zimbabwe's rights record hasn't improved.
So it would be wrong for anybody, any institution, or any progressive people to have, you know, the sanctions removed on the falsehood that human rights situation has improved in Zimbabwe, because the reality is that actually they have worsened. We are in a far, far much worse situation. So if we got sanctions because of human rights abuses, what could actually be happening or should be happening is tightening of those sanctions.
Rachel Kamangira, a member of a pro-government group called Broad Coalition Against Sanctions, has the opposite view. Since February, Kamangira and members of her group have been camped outside the U.S. Embassy in Harare, demanding that the sanctions be lifted.
Those targeted ones, if they get sick, they go somewhere, like in other countries, to get medications. Us, when we get sick, we don't have medications here. They were targeting our former president. Right now, he's no longer ruling this country. But the ones who are suffering are ordinary Zimbabweans.
The 43-year-old widow says that once the sanctions are lifted, the economy will improve and she will be able to find a job and send her three children to school. But Daniel Ndlela, a former economics professor at the University of Zimbabwe, says Harare first has to cut expenditures and deal with corruption before there can be any economic improvement. Sanctions, he says, have little to do with Zimbabwe's economic problems.
The idea is that if sanctions are lifted, we'll immediately have loans coming through. But that won't happen until we service the debts we owe to the IFIs, international finance institutions. The money we owe all around is not due to sanctions.
Zimbabwe has been mostly cut off from international loans and foreign investment since the early 2000s due to Mugabe's abuses and policies seen as unfavorable to outside companies. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Poison by Daddy Lumba. We've been listening to Daddy Lumba with the song Poison. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for making us a part of your evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
So someone got resolved. Oh, oh, oh. Someone got a new